had a relapse of the cold that I had here for over a week, and I was miserable while I was there in the flesh, but encouraged in the spirit. Certainly wonderful to see the good numbers that came out. I expect that we probably had around 250 or more every night with visitors from other congregations, from the community. A preacher that preaches for the Church of Christ in Tuttle, Oklahoma, where I grew up, a church that has been institutional, liberal since really since those issues came up all through my childhood and adult years. Some of the members there in Tuttle invited him to come, and maybe a door was open there, but even a lot of others that were outside of the body of Christ came and heard the gospel, some for the first time. And so it was a very encouraging week, and appreciate your prayers. So glad to be back here safely with you. In Mark chapter 8, the text of our study this morning, Jesus said in verse 35, Mark 8 and verse 35, "For whoever desires to save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake and the gospel's will save it. For what will it profit a man if he gains the whole world and loses his own soul? Or what will a man give in exchange for his soul?" This is a reference that we go to often to bring out the point of what it means to truly surrender to Jesus. And I want to look at that this morning because it speaks volumes about the life that we are called upon to live as Christians in order to come to Christ, in order to be saved. Jesus tells us that there is something that we have to surrender, that we have to give up. He talks about losing our life. And that's not necessarily the way that we use the term. He lost his life in battle or something like that. He's not necessarily calling upon us to die a physical death, while that may be necessary in order to stay true to Christ. He's talking about losing our life in the sense that we let go, in the sense that we surrender and quit trying to control and to have what we want to have. We surrender our life to Christ. He says, whoever desires to save his life will lose it, but he who loses his life for my sake and the gospel's will save it. This concept is one of saying, I no longer am going to try to rule my life. I'm no longer going to try to sit on that throne and be king of my life. I'm going to let you rule my life. Paul put it this way in Galatians 2. It's no longer I who live, but Christ lives in me. When he said it's no longer I who live, it's not that he was dead. He was dead metaphorically to the world. He was dead to his past life. He had been separated from that. But now he has surrendered his life so that whichever way Christ directs it, he says, I'm willing to go in that particular way. Well, that's because Jesus says that's the only way that we'll save our life. This is much like the paradox that we see in the Beatitudes. Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness, and so on. Here he's telling us that while this goes against human wisdom, Jesus said the only way for you to save your soul, that part of you that's eternal, to have life that will never end, is to surrender this short temporal life. Now, from just an intellectual and a logical standpoint, if we can remove ourselves from the situation and look at it from the standpoint of, here's a life that is for a relatively short number of years, and then here's a life that is eternal. It never ends. Here's a short life that is filled with trouble and sorrow. No matter how righteous or good or wise we might be, there's still going to be temptation and trouble and sadness and sorrow and loss. And then here is an endless life that is filled with nothing but blessing and good. And so someone makes this offer. If you surrender this short life filled with sorrow, I'll give you one that lasts forever that is filled with nothing but blessing and good. That's a no-brainer, as we would say. I mean, it's easy just from an academic standpoint to look at that and to say, how could I not accept that offer? I can't believe it's being offered to me. Something that is so insignificant for something that is grand and glorious and wonderful. But then when we put ourselves back into the situation, now it's my life. Now it's my life today. Now it is what I want to do today, I have to surrender. What I want to do tomorrow, what I want to do next year, I have to surrender. And for the rest of my life, and I don't even know how long that's going to be. What we've got to remember is the rest of my life might be for a few more hours. It might be for another day or for a few more weeks. We really don't know. And the shorter that time is, obviously the better the deal is, right? We just have to accept that no matter how long we live, it's going to be far better for us to accept this offer. In Galatians chapter 5, and in verse 16, Paul said, I say then, walk in the Spirit, and you shall not fulfill the lusts of the flesh, for the flesh lusts against the Spirit, and the Spirit against the flesh, and these are contrary to one another, so that you do not do the things that you wish. Being directed by the Spirit of God, surrendering our life, means that yes, there are going to be times that this would not be my choice. The Bible reveals to us, though, that once having done that, we realize this wouldn't have been my choice, but it sure was a lot better than what I would have chosen. In the end, it's always better for a wife to make that conscious decision to submit herself to her husband. While that is not a natural inclination for the most part, it's not an easy choice, it's a frightening choice on many occasions. In the end, when we live that obedient will of God, the wife finds that this is what brings happiness. God knows that. When the husband is selfless and loves his wife as Christ loved the church and gives himself for her, well, that means he surrenders a lot of other things and he cannot be selfish. He cannot pursue his own way, but look out for her best interest first. That may not be the natural inclination and the easiest thing to do, but in the years to come, he realizes that was the best choice. That's actually what made me happier than if I would have chosen the other. This is just the idea behind Mark chapter 8 and verses 35 through 37. Jesus is calling upon each one of us to make a decision. And this is what it boils down to. We're either going to surrender ourself, or we're going to sell ourself for something that is short and really filled with sorrow. Passing pleasures of sin. But as a whole, if we were to weigh it out in the end, the percentage would be far more filled with sorrow and suffering than the pleasure that we might have gained. We have a choice. Romans chapter 6, and in verse 16 he says, in Romans chapter 6, turn there and notice in verse 16, he says, do you not know that to whom you present yourselves slaves to obey, you are that one slaves whom you obey, whether of sin leading to death or of obedience leading to righteousness. Here's this choice. You can obey sin or you can obey righteousness. And here's the path. Here's where it leads. Sin leads to death. Righteousness leads, obedience leads to righteousness. Look up in verse 13. He says, and do not present your members as instruments of unrighteousness to sin, but present yourselves to God as being alive from the dead and your members as instruments of righteousness to God. It is this simple. This is what we're called on to do. And really what we're looking at here is, do I want my reward now or do I want it later? In Matthew chapter 6, Jesus several times speaks about they have their reward now, in contrast to those who wait for their reward. And they receive by far the greater reward. In Matthew 6 and in verse 2, he says, when you do a charitable deed, do not sound a trumpet before you, as the hypocrites do in the synagogues and in the streets, that they may have glory from men. Assuredly, I say to you, they have their reward. He says, that's all they get. All they're going to get out of that charitable deed is the glory of men. It is not lasting. It doesn't gratify. That's all they get for that charitable deed. In verse 5, and when you pray, you should not be like the hypocrites, for they love to pray standing in the synagogues and on the corners of the streets, that they may be seen by men. Assuredly, I say to you, they had their reward. They've chosen to get their reward now instead of receiving it later from God. Verse 16, again, he speaks about the same thing in regard to fasting. In Hebrews 11 and in verse 25, I know you're familiar with the passage speaking about Moses and his decision. It says that he chose rather to suffer affliction with the people of God than to enjoy the passing pleasures of sin. It's telling us that there is a pleasure to sin, but that it's fleeting. It doesn't abide. It doesn't gratify. It doesn't stay. It doesn't fill us up. It's just one of those fleeting, momentary feelings of pleasure, and then it's gone. And that's what makes it so deceiving, is because people chase it over and over again. But obedience leads to a greater reward that comes later. Romans chapter 6, going back to where we were earlier, in Romans 6 and in verse 22, Paul says, but now having been set free from sin and having become slaves of God, you have your fruit to holiness and the end, everlasting life. So, we can forego some pleasures now, even suffer shortly, and receive a reward that cannot even be imagined or described later. Or we can enjoy some pleasure that is just momentary, just like that. Still have suffering and sadness in this life, and then have eternal suffering that is so horrific that it cannot be described or imagined. Again, it ought to be obvious. 1 Peter chapter 1, he says in verse 6, in this you greatly rejoice, though now for a little while, if need be, you've been grieved by various trials, that the genuineness of your faith, being much more precious than gold that perishes, though it is tested by fire, may be found to praise, honor, and glory at the revelation of Jesus Christ. Notice that. A genuine faith, much more precious than gold, because it lasts. Gold doesn't. Nothing in this life does. He says that that faith will be found when it endures. It will be found to praise and honor and glory at the revelation of Jesus Christ. Verse 9, receiving the end of your faith, the salvation of your souls. Obviously, the end is better than in the beginning. You know, going back to that text in Matthew chapter 6, where he talks about those who pray standing in the streets have their reward. Those who do their good deeds to be seen by men, they have their reward. Well, in contrast to that, in Matthew 6 and verse 4, that your charitable deed may be in secret, and your Father who sees in secret will Himself reward you openly. In verse 6, when you pray, go into your room. When you shut your door, pray to your Father who is in the secret place, and your Father who sees you in secret will reward you openly. He's making the contrast between the immediate, momentary reward and that which is lasting forever. What we're seeing here is that when we find the word redemption or redeem, it implies that we have sold ourselves, like Esau sold his birthright. In Hebrews 12, you'll remember in verse 16, lest there be any fornicator or profane person like Esau who for one morsel of food sold his birthright. He's emphasizing that that was such a ridiculous trade that Esau made. For one meal, he sold something that would last throughout the generations of his offspring. What a foolish man. A person who wants momentary gratification. I don't care about what's going to happen to people for generations and generations. I want something right now. And in less than an hour, the pleasure of that was gone forever. Balaam was one who sought immediate gratification instead of being faithful to God. Jude chapter 1, of course, just one chapter there, and in verse 11, 2 Peter 2 and verse 15. The point is that when we surrender, when we sell ourselves at such a discounted rate. It's like hawking something at a pawn shop. We don't get anywhere near the value of what we are selling, our soul. And then we have no power with which to buy it back. Jesus will buy our soul back, but we have to surrender to Him. So what this is all about is to choose this day who you will serve. Are we going to surrender or are we going to sell everything? I want us to look at some areas in life where we make this decision to either surrender to Christ or to sell our soul. And there are several different examples that we find in the Bible, both in the Old Testament and in the New, where people have decided to go one direction or the other. They either surrender themselves and move toward Christ and toward eternity, or they sell themselves and they move toward degradation and destruction and suffering. One of the areas that I believe that we see this, one of the first areas that I want to notice, is in the realm of purity. And I believe that there are probably a lot of different examples that we could look at or contrasts that we could see in the Bible, but probably one of the best and the first that come to mind would be that of Joseph. In Genesis chapter 39, we read about Joseph, one who surrendered himself to God instead of selling his soul and losing his purity. In Genesis 39, if you'll turn there, verse 1, the Bible says, Joseph had been taken down to Egypt, and Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, captain of the guard, an Egyptian, bought him from the Ishmaelites who had taken him down there. The Lord was with Joseph, and he was a successful man. He was in the house of his master, the Egyptian, and his master saw that the Lord was with him and that the Lord made all he did to prosper in his hand. So Joseph found favor in his sight and served him, and he made him overseer of his house, and all that he had he put under his authority. So it was from the time that he made him overseer of his house and all that he had that the Lord blessed the Egyptian's house for Joseph's sake. And the blessing of the Lord was on all that he had in the house and in the field. Thus he left all that he had in Joseph's hand. He did not know what he had except for the bread which he ate. Now Joseph was handsome in form and appearance. And it came to pass after these things that his master's wife cast longing eyes on Joseph. And she said, "Lie with me." But he refused and said to his master's wife, "Look, my master does not know what is with me in the house. He has committed all that he has to my hand. There is no one greater in this house than I, nor has he kept back anything from me but you, because you're his wife. How then can I do this great wickedness and sin against God?" So it was as she spoke to Joseph day by day that he did not heed her to lie with her or to be with her. But it happened about this time when Joseph went into the house to do his work, and none of the men of the house was inside, that she caught him by his garment, saying, "Lie with me." But he left his garment in her hand and fled and ran outside. And so it was when she saw that he had left his garment in her hand and fled outside that she called to the men of her house and spoke to them, saying, "See, he's brought into us a Hebrew to mock us. He came in to me to lie with me, and I cried out with a loud voice. And it happened when he heard that I lifted my voice and cried out that he left his garment with me and fled and went outside." So she kept his garment with her until his master came home. Then she spoke to him the words like these, saying, "The Hebrew servant whom you brought to us came in to me to mock me. So it happened as I lifted my voice and cried out that he left his garment with me and fled outside." So it was when his master heard the words which his wife spoke to him, saying, "Your servant did to me after this manner," that his anger was aroused. Then Joseph's master took him and put him into the prison, a place where the king's prisoners were confined, and he was there in the prison. This is a tragic event, especially when we look at a young man who was determined to maintain his purity, to resist temptation, and to surrender his self to God, to let God direct his life. Remember what we read in Galatians chapter 5, that if we are led by the Spirit, if we're directed by the Spirit, we do not do the things that we wish. Joseph could relate to that. He wasn't willing to just be led by his own lusts. He was led by what he knew God willed for him, even at a time in his life when things weren't going right. You know, sometimes when we're experiencing some difficult times, we use those as an excuse to turn away from God. Not Joseph. Joseph stands as that example. The true faith, that genuine faith, is not moved by circumstances. What Joseph was going through in his life was unfair. And all of us will go through some circumstances that are unfair. Losing loved ones, maybe losing a job, maybe losing friends, being cast off, being persecuted, whatever it might be. There are a lot of unfair things that happen to us. And there are a lot of people that are looking for that excuse, for that opportunity to be the victim, to try to garner sympathy, and to be disobedient to God. I want to tell you, God is not fooled by that. God is not moved by the situations in life that trouble us. He is moved with sympathy. He cares for us. Don't get me wrong. He cares deeply. We have a high priest who sympathizes with us, but he doesn't buy the excuse that that's the reason that we disobey God. He never will. Now, people around you might. People around me might. But God doesn't. Because God had a servant, Joseph, who had been treated so unfairly again and again and again. But he trusted God. He knew that all things work together for good to those who love the Lord. So he was steadfast, always abounding in the work of the Lord. And he remained his purity even here. After his brothers had sold him into slavery, he would not turn away from God. He was a handsome young man, but he saw this transgression as a sin against God. He recognized it was a sin against his master. He certainly saw the whole picture. And I want to tell you that in order for us to really surrender to the Lord and to maintain our purity, we're going to have to understand that a transgression is not just bringing a bad consequence for us, or not just something that is against this person or that person, but foremost, primarily, it is a sin against God who loves us and who redeems us and who gave His Son to die for us. In Genesis 39 and in verse 9, you'll remember as He explained to her, "How can I do this great wickedness and sin against God?" So in verse 10, he did not heed her. He didn't give in to her overtures. He wasn't moved by her flattering words. And in verse 12, he fled from her. He did everything right, maybe with one exception. I think about the fact that he went into her house without anyone else in there. Maybe he had to. I don't know. I sure don't want to find fault with Joseph. But if I were going to see anything that might have been a dangerous thing to do, that opened him up for false accusation. We need to never allow ourselves to be in a situation like that. We need to always be in a situation or carry ourselves in a way, as the Apostle Paul said concerning carrying the gift of the Corinthians to the needy saints in Jerusalem. He said that he desired to provide all things honorable in the sight of all men. Therefore, he wanted witnesses to travel with him. We need to make sure that we're providing things honorable in the sight of all men, and that we're making that effort to do what's right. But here's a young man that, for the most part, did everything right, and yet he suffered. Cast into prison, wrongfully so. What's interesting is that God lets us know that even in this unfair state, even suffering to surrender himself to God, verse 21, "But the Lord was with Joseph and showed him mercy and gave him favor in the sight of the keeper of the prison." We've got to understand that when God blesses us, it's not always what we think it ought to be. We would think, well, if Joseph did the right thing and he suffered, if God's going to bless him, he's going to vindicate him. And Potiphar's wife is going to be brought up on charges and she'll be thrown into prison. And Potiphar will be so sorry for what he did and Joseph will be exalted among all the people. That's the way I would have done it. But knowing the rest of the story, I understand that God was preparing Joseph for even greater things. He was going to essentially be the prime minister of Egypt, and he was going to learn some things in prison by being a trustee there that would serve him well as prime minister of Egypt. And so Joseph kept trusting. God kept blessing, not as maybe we would have, but God kept blessing him even there. We've got to learn from this to be content in whatever state we are in. We are content because we know that we're doing the right thing, that we've surrendered ourselves to God. And even if we may not understand the path, we don't understand how this is working out. We don't understand why isn't God exalting me now. Remember in 1 Peter 5, in due time He will exalt you. Humble yourselves under the mighty hand of God. In due time He will lift you up. That is, in His time He makes all things beautiful. That's not in my time. But when I surrender myself, God will bless me. And those blessings sometimes are these little morsels that are sprinkled through my life to remind me, God saying, I'm here with you. It's like that pat on the back. It is that reminder, that arm around our shoulder saying, I'm still with you. It may not all be working out the way you think it should right now, but I'm still with you. Trust me. I will keep bringing these blessings in your life because I'm training you. I'm using these situations to make you better. And there's going to be a time when you will truly be completely exalted. Joseph was. That's why Paul, in a Roman prison, writing to his Philippian brethren, could say in Philippians 4 and in verse 11, I have learned in whatever state I am to be content. I know how to be abased. I know how to abound. Everywhere and in all things I've learned both to be full and to be hungry, both to abound and to suffer need. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. That's how we surrender ourselves. Not with some kind of agreement with God that I'll surrender myself as long as you bless me the way I think I ought to be blessed. It doesn't work that way. God says surrender and trust. I will keep sprinkling these morsels of blessings in your life to remind you, I'm here. I'm in control. I'm not going to let you be destroyed. I am going to bring you up. I'm going to lift you up. I'm going to swoop down and carry you on wings of eagles if you will wait on me and let me make this the way it's supposed to be. This is what it means to surrender. Joseph is that wonderful example. What's the contrast? Obviously, probably David would be the best contrast on the other side of this. And a very good example, because David, in so many areas of his life, is such a great example. But here, he failed miserably. And it's because he didn't surrender here. David was a man who gave his whole heart to God. For the most part, in the greater part of his life, he loved God with all of his heart, mind, and soul. But there was a point in his life where he put himself before the Lord and he didn't surrender. Obviously, 2 Samuel in chapter 11, we find in verse 1 that David's men of war had gone out to battle, but David remained in Jerusalem. It happened one evening that David arose from his bed and walked on the roof of the king's house. And from the roof he saw a woman bathing, and the woman was very beautiful to behold. So David sent and inquired about the woman. Someone said, is this not Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam, the wife of Uriah the Hittite? Then David sent messengers and took her, and she came to him, and he lay with her, for she was cleansed from her impurity. And she returned to her house, and the woman conceived. So she sent and told David and said, I am with child. Then David sent to Joab, saying, send me Uriah the Hittite. Joab sent Uriah to David. When Uriah had come to him, David asked how Joab was doing and how the people were doing and how the war prospered. And David said to Uriah, go down to your house and wash your feet. So Uriah departed from the king's house, and a gift of food from the king followed him. But Uriah slept at the door of the king's house with all the servants of his lord, and did not go down to his house. So when they told David, saying, Uriah did not go down to his house, David said to Uriah, did you not come from a journey? Why did you not go down to your house? Uriah said to David, the ark and Israel and Judah are dwelling in tents, and my lord Joab and the servants of my lord are encamped in the open fields. Shall I then go to my house to eat and drink and to lie with my wife? As you live and as your soul lives, I will not do this thing. Uriah was a more honorable man than David. How that must have cut his heart. Verse 12, then David said to Uriah, wait here today also, and tomorrow I'll let you depart. So Uriah remained in Jerusalem that day and the next, and when David called him, he ate and drank before him, and he made him drunk. And at evening he went out to lie on his bed with the servants of his lord, but he did not go down to his house. In the morning it happened that David wrote a letter to Joab and sent it by the hand of Uriah. He wrote in the letter saying, set Uriah in the forefront of the hottest battle and retreat from him that he may be struck down and die. So it was while Joab besieged the city that he assigned Uriah to a place where he knew there were valiant men. Then the men of the city came out and fought with Joab, and some of the people of the servants of David fell, and Uriah the Hittite died also. Then Joab sent and told David all the things concerning the war, and charged the messenger, saying, when you finish telling the matters of the war to the king, if it happens that the king's wrath rises, and he says to you, why did you approach so near to the city when you fought? Did you not know that they would shoot from the wall? Who struck Abimelech, the son of Jerubbaal? Was it not a woman who cast a piece of millstone on him from the wall so that he died in Thebez? Why did you go near the wall? Then you shall say, your servant Uriah the Hittite is dead also. So the messenger went and came and told David all that Joab had sent by him. A lengthy reading, and I know it's a text that we're familiar with, but no matter how many times we've read it, I think that it stings, it hurts to read that such a fine man would allow himself to be caught in such a web of sin and of lies, leading to more deception and more cover-up until he would do the unthinkable. You know, this all began by David allowing himself to look on a woman that he shouldn't have been looking at. The Bible says in verse 2 that he beheld her. He allowed himself to cast those eyes upon her. The Bible makes it very clear that there are some things that we're not to look at. Job said that he made a covenant with his eyes that he would not look on a young woman in that way. I want to tell you, every one of us needs to make that same covenant. Because if this could happen to David, who is superior in his relationship with God, if that can happen to David, it can happen to any of us. And that's where it began. He beheld her beauty. And then in verse 3, he sends his messenger. He begins to ask about her. He pursued her. You know, there, with all the social media that we have, the internet and all the opportunities that people have to go and view pictures, to go and look at someone's profile, to see some of the things that they post, and maybe there's something that lures you into looking further, into looking deeper. That's exactly what David did. We need to have some accountability. We need to make some covenant that we're not going to go down that path. When we know that someone is worldly and that they don't dress in a modest way, why would any Christian who is trying to surrender himself or herself to the Lord and maintain their purity, why would we even go and visit or look at that profile and the other pictures that are posted? What good is going to come from that in any way? About the only thing that's going to happen is what happened to David. It may not happen the first time, but when there's something that's seen there that's alluring, then there's going to be a temptation to go back, to see it again, to see if there's any more. And that's exactly how people are overthrown. He pursues her. He asks about her. And then he sends for her. He brings himself into her company. He should have never done that. This was another man's wife. You say, well, it's innocent. He's just going to honor Uriah's wife. Uriah was a good man. He was a valiant soldier. Here's a beautiful woman. She's pure. David is going to allow her to come and eat at his house. It's pretty obvious that he had other motives. I don't know if he intended to do this or if he was just thinking, I'm not going to go that far. I just want to get to know her. I just want to see her beauty for myself. But he sent for her. She came to his house. And before the evening was over, he lied with her. Was it a romantic weekend? Was it just one night? Whatever the case, he sinned terribly against God. In 2 Samuel in chapter 12 and in verse 9, the prophet said to him, why have you despised the commandment of the Lord to do evil in His sight? You've killed Uriah the Hittite with a sword. You've taken his wife to be your wife and have killed him with the sword of the people of Ammon. He sinned. His pleasure ceased after a few hours, probably. And then the consequences rushed in like a whirlwind. In 2 Samuel 11 and in verse 5, Bathsheba sends a message to the king. I'm expecting your child. Then he attempts a cover-up. He's going to find a way to hide this and bring Uriah back from battle. God says in Proverbs 28 and in verse 13, he who covers his sins will not prosper, but whoever confesses and forsakes them will have mercy. David found this out for sure. God was not going to let him cover this up. Not only did he try to cover it up by bringing Uriah back from battle, then he resorted to murdering a faithful man. In 1 Chronicles 11, it records for us the 30 most valiant men in David's battalion, in his army. In 1 Chronicles 11 and 26 and in verse 41, Uriah the Hittite is named as one of those men. You know, Romans 6 and in verse 19, the Bible tells us that lawlessness leads to more lawlessness. This is something that we've got to understand, that when a person compromises regarding their purity or anything for that matter, once we've compromised and transgressed and sinned against God, we open a door and there is absolutely no end to where we will go as we go through that door. It continues to take us down a path because we know within our heart that we've compromised, that we've transgressed, that we're not in fellowship with God, and so it is easier to take that next step that is close, but just a little bit further. I might as well do this. If I've done that, I might as well do this. And it is a constant digression further and further down that road. Who would have dreamed that David would murder one of his most valiant men? David wouldn't take the life of Saul because he was God's anointed. David was so loyal. He was so faithful. He was so good. How do we find him doing the unthinkable? Because he sold himself. I don't know if he thought because he was king that this was all right. I think it was probably one of those things that one thing led to another and it went out of control and David never got control of it. He never stopped the madness and broke that chain of digression. And so he sinned, and instead of repent, it led him to more sin and deception and lying and murder and so on. A great man's life is forever altered. In Proverbs 6 and verse 23, the commandment is a lamp and the law a light. Reproofs of instruction are the way of life. Proverbs 6, now in verse 24. To keep you from the evil woman, from the flattering tongue of a seductress. Not that Bathsheba was evil in any way, but this is certainly telling us about the consequence of this sin. Verse 25, do not lust after her beauty in your heart, nor let her allure you with her eyelids. For by means of a harlot, a man is reduced to a crust of bread, and an adulteress will prey upon his precious life. Can a man take fire to his bosom and his clothes not be burned? Can one walk on hot coals and his feet not be seared? So is he who goes into his neighbor's wife. Whoever touches her shall not be innocent. David sowed to his flesh. He sold his soul regarding purity. He lost his relationship with God, and he reaped destruction. Galatians 6, verses 7 through 8. Whatever a man sows, that he will also reap. His son, the child that she was expecting with David, his son died. In 2 Samuel 12, verses 15 through 18. He would have to fight forever and deal with death in his family. 2 Samuel 12 and in verse 10. He would even have his own wives taken away from him. 2 Samuel 12 and verses 11 through 12. And that was carried out for sure with Absalom. So what application do we make of this to us? Well, we've been purified. 1 Corinthians 6 and verse 11. Such were some of you, but you were washed. You were sanctified, you were justified in the name of our Lord Jesus by the Spirit of our God. The point of that is, don't sell that purity. He goes on in verse 12, says, all things are lawful, but not all things are helpful. Verse 13, foods are for the stomach for foods, but God will destroy both it and them. The body is not for sexual immorality, but for the Lord, and the Lord for the body. God both raised up the Lord, and He will also raise us up by His power. Do you not know that your bodies are members of Christ? Shall I then take the members of Christ and make them members of a harlot? Certainly not. Or do you not know that he who is joined to a harlot is one body with her? For the two, he says, shall become one flesh, but he who is joined to the Lord is one spirit with him. Flee sexual immorality. Every sin that a man does is outside the body, but he who commits sexual immorality sins against his own body. Or do you not know that your body is the temple of the Holy Spirit, who is in you, whom you have from God, and you are not your own? For you were bought at a price. Therefore glorify God in your body and in your spirit, which are God's. We've got to understand that our purity is of the utmost importance to God, and it determines our reward. We can either surrender that eternal, we can surrender ourselves to the Lord and gain that eternal reward, or we can sell ourselves for momentary pleasure and lose the eternal reward and instead have suffering in this life and inexpressible suffering for eternity. It all begins in our heart. In Proverbs 4 and in verse 23, the wise man says, keep your heart with all diligence, for out of it spring the issues of life. That's where it begins. Well, there's several other areas we'll look at later that have to do with surrendering ourselves or selling ourselves. But hopefully this one will resonate in your heart and your mind, and you'll realize the seriousness of this matter and what Jesus means when He tells us to lose our life so that we can gain it. If you will, bow with me in prayer, and after the prayer we'll be dismissed and go to our Bible classes.